Well, thanks for the introduction. If you were famous enough, I wouldn't require an introduction. So my talk today is, thanks for inviting me to talk here. And my talk today is about entanglement entropy in a strongly random quantum spin chain. And this work was done in close collaboration with Joel Moore of Berkeley. And it's pretty much, can you see the bottom here?
No.
You cannot.
Many people can.
Well, fine. There will be some bottom stuff, so
we'll get 90%.
I'll read it out loud, make the talk longer and more painful. So this is pretty much okay. For those of you who are in the March meeting session on entanglement entropy, this will be somewhat of a repeat, although not completely. There will be much more details here. Here is your green. And so this is at the interface of this talk is at the interface of three different subjects, pretty much: quantum information, conformally invariant field theories, and its focus is actually on strong randomness in quantum magnetism. So I will try to touch upon all three, starting with the definition of entanglement entropy, give you some example of where entropy really shows its universal character. Its entanglement entropy shows its universal character. Move on to talk about entanglement entropy in conformal field theories, and then move on to discuss entanglement entropy in strongly random Heisenberg models, spin half and spin one. So first, entanglement entropy. Entanglement entropy pretty much measures on the system divided into two subsystems, say A and B, how many qubits, how many degrees of freedom in one subsystem is determined by the other. And the way we calculate that is we start with a density matrix, ground state times ground state. We trace over one subsystem, say B. What we obtain is a reduced density matrix, which describes the degrees of freedom in A, which is no longer pure, it's a mixed state with probabilities, which is eigenvalue being probability for various states of subsystem A. And just like
I have a question. Am I using the coordinate? Do you want to make coordinate?
By the US government or by us?
By us.
Okay, you can make the organizer.
I don't know. Usually somebody is here and they give you this device, right? But I have no idea. It's not just a channel problem. Does anybody know? So
you can
turn it on and
you have to. You can just put the talk on the web.
No, you have to turn it on.
Yeah.
Coming
on. And then just somebody's whatever starts recording right away. What would you tell
us? You can also just put the PowerPoint in the way.
You find that my jokes are not that important.
That's for the community to judge here.
The community judged already. So I was in the middle of defining this density matrix, reduced density matrix. Now, just like a statistical mechanics ensemble, you can take this probability and turn them into a von Neumann formula to get an entanglement, to get an entropy. In this case, it will be the entanglement entropy. How many free degrees of freedom subsystem A has? So the formula says sum over pi log p log base 2. This base 2 is important for the quantum information aficionados amongst you. So pi times log pi summed over all states I. And you can also write it without diagonalizing this density matrix as just trace of 4 log rho. You can go through this exercise by first tracing on subsystem A and then calculating the reduced density matrix for B. You'll get the same answer, I guarantee it. And it really measures how many qubits, pretty much, on one subsystem are determined by the other. Now, a very important example for this talk is, what's the entanglement entropy of a singlet state? Take a singlet state for these two spins, A and B. Trace over one of them, B, and you end up with a density matrix that describes spin A as completely at a loss as to what to do. In this ground state, spin A knows that if spin B points down, it needs to point up. If spin B points up, it needs to point down. But if you took away spin B, spin A just have no idea. And this is reflected by probability half to point up, this term, probability half to point down. This is the density matrix. And taking its trace, or just summing over half times log half times 2, you'll just get 1. Which means that there's exactly 1 qubit, well, 1 spin half, that was determined by subsystem B in subsystem A. This is the maximal entanglement, obviously, that subsystem A can have. Now, why is that important? Why is this research idea can be important? What I'm doing here is I'm taking the concept of entanglement entropy from the realm of quantum information into the realm of condensed matter systems. And we're doing this because entanglement entropy seems to show a lot of universal properties when applied to various bound states. In addition, it encodes in it very important, very interesting properties of very complex bound states of condensed matter. So, for example, let's start with just a simple lattice. Take a slice out of it of diameter L and ask how much is this slice going to be entangled with the rest of the lattice. Just imagine a lot of singlets kind of connecting the inside and the outside. There will be as many singlets as there is contour to this slice. So you're not surprised if I'll tell you that generically at dimensions 2 and higher, entanglement entropy follows an area law, just scales to leading order as the size of the section to the power of p minus 1. There could be corrections to that, subleading terms. But this is generically the case, especially for gap phases. This is not the case, however, when you look at fermions. Three fermions, it was shown by Jove and Klich, and intended by Wolf, who I did not mean to put on lowercase. Although Klich is at Caltech, so I'm a little biased. But they showed, through very hard work actually, that the area law actually fails for free fermions. Free fermions reflect, have a Fermi surface, and this is reflected by this extra term of log L in the entanglement entropy. Which means that as you raise the slice that I showed you, free fermions actually show much more entanglement than just how much contour they have. Another interesting example is what happens when you have a topological phase in two dimensions. In that case, the phases gap. Clearly, you will have entanglement entropy that depends on the contour size, which also scales like L. This is two dimensions. But there will be a correction, a constant correction that's independent of the size of the slice. It will depend only on the topological content of the theory at hand that determines the ground state. So this was found by Kitaev and Peskin, independently by Levin and Wen. Now, as interesting is a recent result by Moore and Fatkin about two-dimensional Gaussian quantum critical points. In this case, ungapped phases. I'm not going to talk a lot about this. I'm just going to highlight this result and say why it's interesting. It has the entanglement entropy of a slice of a lattice, of a slice of the system with the rest of the system, does scale like an area law to leading order, but here there's a logarithmic correction whose coefficient, alpha, depends on the topology of the slice you're taking, how many corners it has, how many times it turns around. Again, a universal term over here. So if we summarize, here there's a log L extra that indicates that free fermions have something special, a Fermi surface. Here we have a universal correction to the area law, which contains information about the topological field theory. And here we have a universal law correction, which contains information on the topology of the partition you're looking at.
Sorry, this last case is z equals 2.
Exactly.
Four.
Yeah.
So does anyone work down?
Well, okay, so less pathological two-dimensional quantum critical points, you mean?
Yeah.
These are the known examples so far. I think Shinsei worked on generalization in higher dimensions for conformal field theories. There's also work, one dimension, but z equals 2 critical points with Kun Yang did for magnets. I'm not sure whether it's up or not yet.
I mean, presumably, there are not too many 2D Gaussian
right.
quantum critical points.
No, these are pathological, but I mean, these are some. These exist. They're pathological, but they show very interesting characteristics of disentanglement entropy. These are not worked out to my knowledge. But
this is large N. It's also
gassy. Well, it's kind of hard to do perturbation theory with this quantity. Because some of P log P is a highly singular function.
Even at N equals infinity.
Yeah. I mean, it depends. It might be possible. But I don't know if those effects work. My focus is random spin chains, and particular random Heisenberg model. And I would like to, before going completely random, let's say pure for a little bit, and talk about pure conformally invariant spin chains, namely, well, for instance, the Heisenberg model in one dimension. So the Heisenberg model in one dimension has, well, this is a Hamiltonian, it has uniform nearest neighbor coupling, and it does not break any symmetries, does not show long-range order, it has algebraically decaying correlations of basically anything with anything. And its low-energy behavior is determined by a conformally invariant field theory. And by that, we can also say that it is described by a central charge of this conformal field theory that determines most of its thermodynamic properties, like free energy, heat capacity, etc. As it turns out, this central charge also determines the entanglement entropy of a segment of length L of the Heisenberg model or any conformally invariant field theory with the rest of the chain. In this case, we ask, how many qubits, how many degrees of freedom are determined in segment A by the rest of the chain, B? And this turns out to scale to leading order as a central charge over 3 times log base 2 of L. Now notice this base 2. This base 2 is from the definition of the phenomenon entropy with base 2. Now this result was obtained by Halsey, Larson, and Wilczek already in 94. More recent redos were done by Kitaev and Vidal and Cardi and Calabrese. Very interesting work in its own right. And here I'm listing some central charges of some models close to my heart. The Heisenberg model and XXZ chain have central charge 1, so they look like two chiral fermions. Transverse field Ising model, another important model, which has central charge half, and it looks like one chiral fermion or one bosonic channel. Since you can't see the bottom line, I'll leave it for later. It says spin k over 2 Heisenberg models, but I'll leave it for later. Now, so this model, in your mind, should relate to this slide of highly universal contributions to entanglement entropy. In this case, the entanglement entropy to leading order is universal, and it's determined directly by the central charge. Now, this uber universality of the entanglement entropy, particularly in this conformally invariant field theories, led us to ask, what about random spin chains? How does entanglement entropy scale or behave in random spin chains? Does it scale the same? Does it have a universal coefficient to this log if it does? And the answer, as I will show you now, turns out to be yes on both counts.
So Guillaume, should I also think of this as the violation of the area law that was mentioned earlier?
That's a great question. So the area law I mentioned for dimensions 2 and up. Uh-huh. I was careful about that, but it's a very good question. It says that in one dimension, if you have correlations that decay algebraically, it means that as you make this segment larger and larger, the spin that sits in the middle of the segment is still correlated with spins outside. It means that as you add more spins, think of about injecting them in the center. No matter how far you are from the edges, they're still correlated and therefore still entangled with the outside. And this will happen generically in critical models in one dimension. And that dictates that the area law will fail because for critical model. Because no matter how far you are from the edges, you're still entangled with things past the edges. and therefore it should grow faster than a constant. Degenerate entropy should grow faster than a constant as a function of L. And generically, that.
But by extension, in the higher dimensions, if it's not a Gaussian fixed point, it gives a sense that it's going to be also a bioregion.
Right. So in higher dimensions, you can have that. But, and that will, might give you a log L contribution, but that log L contribution will be subleading to the L.
The free
for free fermions, the free fermions are extremely unusual. Like I also showed you the contributions for highly critical theory, the Gaussian two-dimensional fixed point, and that obeys an area law. It doesn't have this extra log. But actually, that extra log contribution was a big surprise to the community, and it took a lot of hard work.
But there's no result of interacting critical points in higher dimensions?
No exact results, to my knowledge, but there's some attempt to do it perturbatively. But, you know, the current attempts on doing it perturbatively are, well, the four models are pretty pathological, like all-to-all interaction. Some kind of a completely mean field interaction. And even that was done perturbatively. I should also refer you to Shinsei, who was doing work on generalizing some of these things to higher dimensions. But I think he looked at conformally invariant models, right? So it is interacting.
Yeah, it's interacting, but we get kind of, we don't study field theory itself, we study the dual description. It's hard to analyze interacting, so, yeah.
Do you have anything to say as to whether the multiplicative law is possible?
I think we analyzed a series of theories, interacting series, and we computed the functional form as a function of the system size. And then I think we can expect that the system size dependence itself is not doesn't change for these theories. Maybe they change some coefficient or universal constant terms.
But then what is, so he showed two examples, free fermions,
right,
and this conformal critical point, which
right,
have different behaviors.
Free fermion theory is not conformal invariant. But like you said, 2 plus 1 dimensional large N,
yeah,
ON model is conformal invariant. So I guess we know the functional forms, but it has some universal terms which depends on N. But we can't compute this coefficient because it's hard to develop systematic computation of this coefficient.
So I should take it that none of those models have multiplicative law.
Interpress 1D?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Can you come up with a system gate or 2 Heisenberg model?
I will extensively later. But if you want to ask the question, go ahead.
The fun, good question. So I thought the interesting is they're not critical.
I'll explain this. Biquadratic coupling.
Okay.
I'll explain this. Ask me again in a few slides. I'll get there. So in the next few slides, I'm going to concentrate on random spin half Heisenberg model and show you roughly how we get the entanglement entropy, what it is, and then go back and discuss how it relates to the entanglement entropy, possibly, conformal field theories, and then go on to discuss the spin K over 2. I think black holes was the motivation. Yeah, I mean this paper was entropy of black holes, and there's a question of when you have an event horizon, it's as though you traced out part of your system, the part that is in the black hole, and then you leave a mixed state of what we live in. And that means that mixed state reflects some entanglement with the black hole. And this is how much. Okay, so moving on, the focus of the talk is really spin change with randomness, which puts me on a bit of firmer grounds as well. So consider a Heisenberg model that now has a coupling J that varies from site to site. Now, this model is definitely not conformally invariant. It does not have any translational invariance. In fact, it cannot be dealt with in terms of bosonization or Bethe-Ansatz or any such, you know, favorite method. And yeah, it's a good question, what do we do with it? So one way is to just ignore the existence of this model and say that it's just a dirty model or something and not think about it at all. You're trapped in the other option, which is to consider it. So one thing that was suggested to deal with this Hamiltonian was, instead of hinging on translational invariance, let's think of the opposite limit. Let's think of these J's as varying really, really widely. In which case, we can maybe solve this problem as a series of solutions of single bonds. So look at this chain. Over here, J2 is the largest. Let's assume that its neighbors are so much smaller that we can just diagonalize the largest bond, put it in its ground state, and then incorporate the rest of the chain through perturbation theory. Diagonalizing this bond is very easy. Just put sites 2, spins 2, and spin 3 in a singlet. That freezes them out. Now, these two terms appear through second-order perturbation theory. They induce quantum fluctuations of this singlet, which in turn gives you an effective interaction between sites 1 and site 4. This effective interaction is basically this coefficient times this coefficient over the gap, J2. So the J to the left times the J to the right over the J in the middle, which is the largest bond in this chain. And therefore, this resulting coefficient is much smaller, definitely from J2, but also it's smaller than J1 and J3. I don't know if you can see this. This is just a repeat of this formula. Now, the reason why it's smaller than all these J's because J1 over J2 is smaller than 1. So is J3 over J2. This is the way we chose it. Now, it is useful to define J2, which was the largest coupling in this Hamiltonian, the largest coupling in the chain, as omega. This will be the highest energy scale in the Hamiltonian, and we can constantly reduce it. And by doing that, we can solve this Hamiltonian through a real space renormalization group. So this technique was pioneered by Madhus Gupta and Hu back like 28 years ago, and later evolved into our current picture of random spin chains in one dimension. So if you carry this scheme to its logical conclusion, you'll start by putting singlets between nearest neighbors, which are strongly interacting. But after a while, singlets will start appearing due to renormalized couplings between spins that are further apart and sometimes very further apart. This picture is actually the random singlet space of the random Heisenberg model. Turns out that any amount of disorder would take the pure Heisenberg model into this space. Now, this is a pretty unusual phase, and to get a feeling for that, let's talk a little bit about its correlations. So if you ask about spin-spin correlations in this phase, and you just pick two sites at random, say these two sites, well, this is a localized phase. You expect correlations to that exponentially, and they do. A little slower than what you expect. They fall off like square root of the distance because the singlets, they give you shortcuts for correlation. Now, this is the typical correlation between two sites. Nevertheless, every once in a while, you'll end up choosing two sites that are bound in one of the singlets, in which case correlation would be 1, or minus 1, if you insist. Now, when we average over this order, it turns out that the average correlations would just be dominated by these events in which you just hit a singlet, and therefore the correlation would just be the probability out of all realizations that indeed you're looking at two sides bound in a singlet. That probability turns out to fall algebraically, like 1 over L squared, only slightly faster than the correlation of the Heisenberg model. Now, I would like to take, you know, 2-3 slides to discuss the theory in more detail, since, you know, most of us here are theorists. And Those of you who are technically inclined, I'm sure would like this. Those of you who are not, well, you can take a nap for 5 minutes, or you can get a flavor for the theory. If you want me to speed up through this, so tell me. So right now, what we have in our arsenal fighting this dirty Heisenberg model is this Madhus-Gupta rule. The effective J under the summation is the J to the left and J to the right over the gap, the energy scale, omega. I drop the factor of half. Trust me, it doesn't matter. If you don't trust me, ask me in a few minutes. Now, this rule tells you how J's behave as you renormalize, as you reduce the energy scale of the Hamiltonian. Now, these J's, at any given state, vary from 0 to omega. As we renormalize bonds, omega will go down, and that range will change. Now, it would be really nice if instead of talking about J's, we can talk about parameters for each bond that vary from 0 to infinity, rather than from 0 to some energy scale. Now, in addition, this rule is given as a product. It would be really, really nice if we can make it into a sum. You can, you know, kill those two birds with one stone if you define for each bond, instead of J, a parameter beta, which is log of the energy scale over J. All J's are smaller than omega. That's the highest energy scale in the Hamiltonian. Therefore, when beta is 0, this reflects J's that are the highest energy scale. As you're considering bonds that are weaker and weaker, they'll be reflected by betas that are larger and larger. Because this definition is a log, you can just take the log of this rule, and you see that the RG rule, the renormalization group rule, is just the sum of beta to the left plus beta to the right. Okay, no, it does not. It does not. And maybe I should emphasize this better. What we're going to do now, what we're trying to do, is obtain the properties, the low energy properties of the Heisenberg model by using a series of real space renormalization group steps, decimating strong bonds, going to the next strong bonds, going to the next strong bonds. As we do that, omega is going to drop. And all the bonds that have J larger than omega are the ones we decimate. Those are the ones we normalize. And if we do it enough, omega will reach 0, at which point we will have run out of bonds. So actually, the next definition, what we add it, is an RG scale definition, gamma. Let's parameterize omega, the running UV cutoff of the Hamiltonian, using the initial energy scale, omega I, that was the largest bond of the initial chain. Now, and let's define gamma as log of omega I over omega. As we renormalize, big omega is going to drop. So we start with gamma equals 0, omega equals omega initial. As the RG progresses, omega drops, and this is reflected by this new parameter, gamma growing. It turns out to be easiest to discuss the RG procedure with this flow parameter gamma. Now, what are we after? We start with some distribution of couplings, P of beta as a function of beta. Now, as we normalize the chain, we're going to reduce the energy scale from omega to omega minus d omega. That would mean eliminating a series of strong bonds. These strong bonds are reflected by really small betas, the bonds that sit over here. And the question is, well, first question is, how many bonds do we have here? So as we change omega to omega minus d omega, you can just take a differential of this equation, and you see that d gamma is d omega over omega. If you take the same differential over here, you see that because omega changed a little bit, each bond is going to have a beta that's shifted by a little bit to the left. It's going to have minus. So d beta is minus d omega over omega, which means that all these bonds on this distribution are going to just move as is to the left, leaving you this orange sliver, you know, off the boat. That's why we renormalize. Those are the strong bonds that we're going to renormalize. And the fact that these two terms are the same tells you that the number of bonds that found themselves off the boat is d gamma times the probability of being with beta equals 0. Now, the procedure is simple. You just each bond that's strong has a bond to its left and a bond to its right that also finds itself off the board because they just drown with the big bond. But they stay there by producing a new blue bond at the sum of the two betas. This looks simple, or maybe it doesn't look so simple, but I assure you the integral differential equation in the bottom of the board here is even more scary. I don't know if you can see, but this is, so over here I wrote an equation that actually describes this flow procedure. It was first written, I believe, by Mahendas Gupta and then analyzed very efficiently by Daniel Fisher. So on the left term, it looks complicated, but actually quite simple. On the left, we just ask, how does P change with gamma? How does the distribution be normalized with gamma? First term on the right is dP d beta. That's just the term that tells you that the whole distribution has to shift to the left to make those strong bonds sink. Then the second term is just the convolution that tells you that you remove beta r and beta left, but produce a new bond at the sum of the two. This happens with probability d gamma times p0. And then that times the convolution gives you the extra contribution of this blue bond. Now, in pictures, if the probability after some time will look like this, it'll start, you know, shifting mass to the right because of this rule, and it'll get flatter and flatter. And it turns out that you can solve it. You can solve for a distribution that satisfies this equation, and it looks very simple. It's just an exponential of this parameter beta over the RG flow parameter gamma. So as gamma grows, this becomes flatter and flatter. And the fact that the probability distribution for beta becomes more and more uniform is why we call this phase an infinite randomness phase, an infinite randomness system. In beta, it looks like the randomness becomes larger and larger. Now, this solution looks simple. You may ask whether it actually is an attractor of this equation. And it is. Which means that no matter with what distribution you start, pretty much, after you eliminated enough bonds, you'll end up with this distribution for the remaining bonds. And if you can see through numerics, you can see through stability of this solution in this equation, it's pretty impressive if you try to do it numerically. So no matter what initial conditions you put, no matter what initial distribution you put in, eventually you'll have this distribution at low energies. If you wonder what it looks like in the original parameter J's before I force you to think about the complicated betas, it looks like a parallel distribution. 1 over J to the power of 1 minus 1 over gamma, where gamma is the RG flow parameter. Now, as gamma grows, as RG progresses, this distribution becomes more and more singular over the origin. J's can only go from 0 to omega, but around the origin, there's going to be more and more mass of this J's around the origin, such that when you finish the RG, gamma is infinite, this is not normalizable. It means that all J's are basically at 0. So there's a required question here. Like, why do I think that this works? And what we're doing is a series of an infinite number of perturbation theory steps without guarantee that what we're doing is actually well-defined. So the guarantee actually sits here. The fact that the distribution is so singular around zero tells us that the perturbation theory, as we do it again and again, becomes better and better defined, because if you're renormalizing a bond over here at the energy scale of the Hamiltonian at a given step, the perturbation theory is best if its neighbors are very small. But its neighbors are taken with this distribution, and since all bonds pretty much are in the near zero rather than near omega, you're guaranteed that the neighbors are near zero, and therefore perturbation theory is fantastic. And this becomes better and better as you go to lower and lower energy scales. Okay, apologies for this extra technical slide. Easing up a little bit, I'll say that this probability distribution that Daniel Fisher first obtained is kind of like a cosine function for the theory of triangles. The sense that once you have that, you can do anything you want in terms of understanding the physics of the 1D Eisenberg model. For instance, you may ask, you know, as you progress with your RG, at any given step, there's a number of spins that are undecimated, like this one over here. How many? How many is a function of energy? Clearly, that will tell us something about low energy excitations, low energy susceptibility of the system. The answer is very simple. Every time we renormalize, every time we form a singlet, we eliminate two sites, which means that the change in density is minus 2 times what's the probability or what's the density of the sites that we're actually decimating. That's the density of sites times the probability of finding the bond that you're looking at overboard. But that's just the probability at zero, the probability density at zero, which is 1 over gamma, times d gamma. This is this term, minus 2n d gamma over gamma. Integrating it is very easy. You just get that the density falls off like 1 over gamma squared. As the RG progresses, we see that the density of free spins falls off like 1 over log squared of 1 over the energy scale. This you can turn right away into length energy scaling. Because take 1 over the density, and you get the distance between nearest spins. By the way, the next singlet that you form will be of that length scale because it's only formed between nearest neighbor existing spins. You get that the length scale goes like log of energy squared or log of 1 over energy scales like L to the half. Okay, you can breathe out. That's it for technicalities right now. And I'll say that this random singlet phase that we explored the past few slides is a prime example of an infinite randomness fixed point. In the following sense, we saw that the energy length scaling, instead of the pure systems, 1 over energy goes like L to the Z, where Z is the dynamical scaling exponent, it's log of 1 over energy, which is our gamma, that goes like L to some critical exponent, psi. For the random singlet phase, psi is a half. In addition, we saw that at low energy, if you look at surviving bonds, the bond distribution looks like a power law, with this power 1 minus chi over gamma. We calculated that chi equals 1 for the random singlet phase. However, this psi and this chi are really critical exponents of this model. And you can think of other infinite randomness fixed points which will have the same form of scaling, of low energy distribution, energy length scaling, but with different psis and different chi. The random singlet values, the random singlet universality class will have psi equals half, psi equals 1. Yeah.
Is one way of thinking about the distribution of spins that if I'm at this fixed point, then, and I take some segment event L, then the number of spins with a stretch bigger than some J scales as some parallel less than 1?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
So I'm just trying to get a picture of how I should what this distribution of spins look like. So if I'm at the fixed point and I take a segment which is length L, and I ask how many bonds are spent bigger than some J, I assume that it means that that scales with a power of length which is less than 1. So in the sense that as you scale to large sizes, the fraction in there is 0.
Right. Exactly. Well, let me try to rephrase it in a way that more suits the state. As you look at two sites at length L, if they form a singlet, right, that will happen at a scale that goes like exponent of minus square root of that distance. That will happen at an energy scale, that distance. So that reflects this scaling. So as you renormalize, you form new, weaker bonds. That's why you cannot ask a priori how many bonds you have that are bigger or smaller than a certain amount. But once you reached a scale such that two sites are nearest neighbors, two surviving sites are nearest neighbors, and they have length L, the bond between them is typically of order exponent to the minus square root of L.
Yeah, I guess I was asking more about the fixed point distribution.
It's a fixed point. It's not really a fixed point distribution in the following sense. As you go to lower and lower energy, the distribution changes.
Oh, well, that's under the RG, but I can just stop. I mean,
okay, you can stop, and then, yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I think...
No, but you never get to the fixed point. You only get to the fixed point. There's nothing left.
Well, I mean, it's a fixed point in a rescaled variable, beta over gamma. And that, there you are.
I guess I thought the fixed point would be characterized by some fractal dimension or set of fractal dimensions for K's, less than one.
No, there's a distribution of how the length between nearest neighbor spins goes. But that distribution is self-averaging, as far as I understand. Any other questions about that? Or previous? Okay, so we were, to remind you, we were out to find the entanglement entropy of this fixed point. And the entanglement entropy of this fixed point is actually much easier to understand than the theory of it. Like, as we form singlets, there's going to be a certain number of singlets that connect segment A with segment B. That number of singlets is exactly the entanglement entropy between segment A and segment B. So all we need to do in order to find this entanglement entropy is just count those singlets, and we can do it using this theory of Daniel Fisher of this random singlet space. It's actually not that hard to see how it will scale. So we already calculated that length energy scaling for those singlets goes like L goes like gamma squared, and gamma is its log of 1 over energy. Now if you want to count how many singlets cross this partition, in this case 2, you could just ask, as you renormalize, how many bonds form? And you, so if you're looking at a particular bond, the probability that it's going to be decimated in the next step is the probability distribution of its bond strength times the gamma at theta equals 0, where the bond is strong. This is just, again, 1 over gamma times the gamma. So the probability that when you change the scale by d gamma, you're forming a singlet is just d gamma over gamma. Now we need to integrate our g flow until the length scale of singlets is bigger than the segment, in which case if you form another singlet, it'll just miss your segment. We stop there. We see that the number of singlets across this partition goes like log of gamma. Now we have this special infinite randomness energy length scaling, which tells you that this is proportional to log of the length. There's a half. This half is this psi, the critical exponent. Yeah.
So, in this length energy scaling argument, because Fisher also has a joint probability distribution of adding singlets, particular L, so I think that you use that. We can really use the joint probability distribution for a singlet insertion.
It's not necessary.
It's not necessary
because it's self-averaging. Yeah.
It's self-averaging.
So what Danny is hinting at is that as those singlets form, they're going to form at various, there's no one-to-one correspondence of energy scale and length. For each energy scale, there's a distribution of length at which singlets form. And the question is whether you need to be very careful in finding out what this distribution is, convolving it with the appropriate properties. And the answer is you don't need to do that. Because that distribution is actually self-averaging. And this quantity is also self-averaging. So you can be less careful than you can.
Yeah.
Oh, because I just sit at the partition of the edge, at the end of. So there's the segment L, and I just sit at its wall. And that wall is sitting at the bond. And I'm going to ask, is there a singlet forming on that bond? Once it forms, I have a new bond, a renormalized bond. And then I can ask, is there a singlet that's forming on that renormalized bond? And by that, I take only singlets that connect A and B into account. Now, I can multiply.
What are the forms across the whole length of L? When you connect to the right side, you're sitting on the wall, you're still thinking
that this. Well, there might be one guy like that. But that will be a constant correction.
It will be correction to L independent.
That's right. And we don't care about this. Now we need to multiply this result by 2 because we have 2 walls.
Don't you have to completely integrate out the L piece in order to get the bridge over from the right to the left side?
Yeah, I guess what Victor is saying.
By the time you get that, you're already done with your problem.
Exactly. So there might be a question of whether I need to stop an epsilon before and epsilon after. And that's why it's going to be an edge term rather than a leading contribution. Now, what you need to take home from here is that the number of singlets forms in linear proportion to this log of gamma. It's like there's a good, like if you're a car and you're driving and every once in a while you hit a lamppost and you count those lampposts. Now you know that the number of lampposts you count is, you know, the distance over the distance, the total distance traveled over the distance between lampposts. It seems like distance traveled in this analogy is measured by log gamma. And each singlet is like a lamppost that appears every time that log gamma changes by one. So as you're driving along this RG road, you're counting up singlets, and this is the rate at which you're counting them. Now this result is actually wrong. I've lied here. I lied in a very specific way. I assumed that the distribution of the bond that I'm sitting at is always the same, always the fixed point distribution, but it's not. Because as soon as we renormalize the bond and say that there's a singlet across our partition, the new effective bond is given by the Madhus-Gupta renormalization rule. But that is a convolution of the beta to the left and the beta to the right, the j to the left and the j to the right. It's actually given by this integral. It's given by this function. This function has no support at zero. It means that we have to wait quite a long time before there will be enough strength between this side and this side to actually form a singlet. I completely missed that in the previous slide. It gives the right scaling, but this effect, you know, the fact that we need to wait until the distribution heals, gives you that instead of seeing its lampposts every 1 kilometer, you're seeing it every 3 kilometers. So there's another factor of a third in front of the result that we had in the previous slide. So let me summarize this. So quite generally, we see that entanglement entropy in the random spin chains, we can calculate by counting twice for two walls. The entanglement per singlet over, you know, the distance between singlets in this RG road times how far you can drive for a segment of length L. So for random singlet phase, a singlet is 1. The road to travel between singlets in this log gamma variable is 3. That's what we calculated. And how much RG time do you have in total? It's this psi times log L, half log L in this case. Putting it all together, we get the result for the entanglement entropy for the Heisenberg model in the XXZ chain. It's 1/3 log L. The two cancels this half. Now, remember that in the original definition, we had log base 2 of L. Here we have log base natural of L. So although this looks very much like the result of the pure system, actually it's a different base for the log. And there's a log 2. Once we take it out, there's a log 2 modifying this log 2 L of the pure system. So the result is that the entanglement entropy is log 2 of what it would be if the Heisenberg model were pure. Now looking at this coefficient over here that sits between the third and the log 2, you can think about it as some kind of an effective central charge for the random spin chain. In this case, this 1 times log 2. Now, you may grumble about me calling this an effective central charge. This is by no means a conformal field theory. Nor do I claim that it is. However, it is a descendant of a conformal field theory. And this quantity, this entanglement entropy, that scales the same for the conformal field theory and the random model allows us to compare the two on somewhat of equal grounds. So just for the sake of discussion, we define this as an effective central charge, even though I emphasize this is not a conformal field theory. And there's a reason for why we do this. Okay, so this is the main result of this part. You may wonder about whether it's actually right or not, and others have. For instance, LaFlorenzi did numerics on the XXZ in the extreme easy plane model, which means just the XY model. This line describes entanglement entropy of the pure model. This line describes entanglement entropy of the random model, where the blue dashed line is the log 2 slope. So it seems to work okay. It was also confirmed by Tran and Bonsteel recently in unpublished work so far, and they're working on it, for the Heisenberg model, which is interacting. Okay, so what we calculate is the entanglement entropy for the Heisenberg model, essentially also the XXZ model. We also did the same for the transverse fieldizing model, and we find the result that's, again, half times log 2. Again, the modification was just a log 2. This was done a few years ago. Following us, people started looking at random single phases of other systems. For instance, the n-flavor Potts model, which has a pure central charge, which is quite different than either one or half, this combination. Now, this is n-flavor parafermionic Potts model. It actually does go critical. And what Rose and Takiyara found is that this scales like log, the effective central charge of the random theory is actually log n, log of the number of flavors. As interesting was more recent work by Bonsteel and Yang, who looked at the Fibonacci chain of nonabelian quasiparticles. Now, this chain is, I don't pretend to understand it very well, but you should think about it as a chain of sites where in each site there's a Hilbert space with dimension, there's a Hilbert space that contains not one state, not two states, but this number of states, the golden ratio. As you take a lot of this, is that okay? And what Nick Bonsteel and Kun Yang found is that indeed, for the random singlet phase of this model, which it has, the effective central charge is log of this local dimension of the Hilbert space. And they seem to be able to generalize this to pretty much any random singlet phase, saying that for a random singlet phase, maybe the central charge would be, the effective central charge would be log of the local dimension. Now, looking back at the result for transverse fieldizing model, it used to be half times log 2. You can write it as log of square root of 2. And that should fit with the idea that the transverse fieldizing model could be written as a chain of Majorana fermions. Each site of a Majorana has square root 2 kind of dimension of Hilbert space. And therefore, we get this log square root of 2.
Could you explain the last comment a bit?
So two Majorana fermions make a fermion, right? Okay. Which means that if you can write a chain with Majorana fermions in each site, you need pairs of sites to form Hilbert space with two states. Which means that each site has a square root of that Hilbert space.
I guess it's one way of saying you can't write a flat binding on that.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So this result is very understandable for spin chains with Hilbert space sites 2, 3, 4 on each side. It's kind of remarkable that it also fits chains that have this non-orthodox quantum dimensions. Yes, that's the upshot. But it seems like the random singlet phase, we pretty much know what's going on. The effective central charge looks like log of the local number of the local dimension of the Hilbert space. Now, we put conformal field theories in deep freeze. Let's go back to them for a second. So the interesting thing, one interesting thing about conformal field theories, they have a C theorem. So the central charge along flows between one conformal field theory to another is never increasing. It can either stay the same or decrease, but it will never increase. Now, we're saying that the Heisenberg model, for instance, is a conformal field theory that's unstable to randomness and flows to an infinite randomness fixed point. Is it possible to extend the C theorem to this extended generalized central charge and say that maybe the C pure is always larger or equal to the central charge of the infinite randomness fixed point? The point that we checked, it was okay because we always got a product of log 2. Log 2 is about 0.7, so it's smaller than 1. This is the question. Turns out this is not always true. So in Santacchiara's work on the parafermionic Potts model, it turns out that there's a violation of this conjecture at 42 flavors. Now, I was asked deliberately not to mention the analogy between 42 flavors, this number of 42 and the meaning of life in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So I haven't managed to refrain, but it turns out that this is violated for power fermionic pot model with number of flavors 42 and up. So this cannot be true. But there's another way this might be generalizable to random spin chains, which is, what if an infinite randomness fixed point flows to another infinite randomness fixed point? Can we say somehow that the real space RG always eliminates entanglement entropy and therefore renders an effective central charge over here always bigger or equal to the effective central charge over here? This is, the jury is still out on that. And what we were trying to do, Joel and I, is to try to attack a problem that may shed light on this aspect. So all these points are random singlet fixed points. But there are actually infinite randomness fixed points that are non-random singlets. Examples of that are the spin examples of that live in the spin K over 2 Heisenberg model, which have special critical points tuned by biquadratic and higher order S dot S interactions. And they're described by SU 2 level K conformal field theories. Those have central charges 3K over K plus 2. For K equals 1, this is the spin half, you get 1. But already for K equals 2, which is quite a spin 1 Heisenberg model, we'll get 3 halves. Already much more interesting. What is the effective central charge of the random theory in this case? Now, in the random spin chain, this will actually describe a fixed point between the Haldane phase and the random singlet phase of that model. So, it's 1 o'clock now. We had a lot of discussion. I don't know. I'll just tell you briefly what I'm going to say before asking if I should say it. So the more recent work on this that I'm going to describe without technicalities is the entanglement entropy for this more complicated non-random singlet infinite randomness fixed point. This is a more interesting model, the spin 1 Heisenberg model. We obtain in the end that indeed this central charge is actually smaller than the central charge of the pure theory, larger than the random singlet phase. I will describe it and tell you a few words what the critical point looks like. This will take about 15 minutes, so I don't know if you want me to go through it or not. People want to leave. Okay, so we're undertaking so trying to shed light on this conjecture of effective central charge decreasing along infinite randomness flows. And also trying to find more of those, trying to find out more about how entanglement entropy behaves in more complicated infinite randomness fixed points, we undertook this more complicated problem of understanding the spin 1 Heisenberg model in its strongly random limit. So, first of all, what is this model? So if you consider a spin 1 Heisenberg model, you can think of each side as split into two spin halves and symmetrized. Which means that when you have a Heisenberg model that's uniform, it pays to put spin half singlets pretty much everywhere. You can think about it as strong bonds localizing spin half singlets, but now there isn't much variation of bonds, so this spin half singlets will happen pretty much everywhere. This is the picture of the AKLP state of the spin one chain, and it's a caricature of the Haldane phase. To rephrase, the spin one chain with a Heisenberg model, with a uniform Heisenberg model, has a gap. It's in the Haldane phase. And this is a way of seeing it. You can think of it, of each bond localizing a spin half singlet. You can do it in such a way that each spin one has a singlet in both the left and the right. There's a uniform state. And in this phase diagram, you can see it over here in the pure side. Okay, now what happens when we put strong randomness in this model? In case of strong randomness, strong bonds would like to localize not one singlet, but two singlets to take advantage of the most energy you can get. And what you end up getting is pretty much the random singlet phase with strong bonds localizing two singlets each and leftover sites having spin one. This happens at very strong randomness. Now, notice that because the leftover over here is spin 1, and each site has spin 1, in the random singlet phase of this case, the effective central charge is not log 2, but log 3, log of the local number of the local dimension of the Hilbert space. But the question is, at the finite randomness, there will be a phase transition between the Haldane phase, this uniform phase, and the random singlet phase. This will happen at a critical disorder, and it will also be an infinite randomness fixed point. But that infinite randomness fixed point is not a random singlet phase. And the question is, what we're out for is finding the universal effective central charge of that fixed point. Now, in this fixed point, the state doesn't look as simple as this, and not even as simple as that. It's actually quite complicated. And just venting for two slides, you can have configurations like that, which a bunch of singlets connecting nearest neighbor sites, but with another singlet decimating them, and then singlets going over. You can even have configurations like this. You'll have spin half singlets forming between two nearest neighbor bonds. Now, if you think about it, this site is eliminated. We have a spin half left over here, spin half left over here, but they're on the same sublattice, which means that they interact ferromagnetically. And this ferromagnetic interaction can actually form a new spin one cluster out of these guys that then gets decimated just as before in some way. Now just imagine trying to calculate entanglement entropy along this partition between the left and the right. It's not as simple as just calculating the number of singlets. But it's possible. So although the state looks very ugly, there's a very beautiful theory that describes it. Dunlan and Hughes showed that you can actually describe the critical point of the spin 1 Heisenberg chain as a competition between three domains. You can think of a domain in which odd bonds localize two singlets, even bonds localize none. This will be the 2-0 domain, 2-0. There's an evil twin sister, 0-2, which has two singlet bonds on the even sides, but no bonds on the odd sides. And there's a third domain, which is just a Haldane phase, the uniform valence bond solid of this model. Now, the effective degrees of freedom in this model at low energies are given as domain walls between these domains. For instance, if you go from 0-2 to 2-0 domain, there's a leftover spin 1 in between. If you go from 2-0 to 1-1, there will be a leftover spin half over here. Now, it is interactions between these domain walls at low energies that gives you infinite randomness scaling and the physics of the fixed point. Now, just notice that the random singlet fixed point is actually a competition between these two domains, the 2-0 and 0-2, which fits because domain walls are spin 1. Random singlet phase is spin 1 random singlet phase. OK, using the domain wall theory, we can figure out the critical properties of the spin 1 critical point. It still has, so I guess it's important to say that at criticality, all those three domains appear with equal probability. And the energy length scaling is still infinite randomness scaling, log of 1 over energy scales like L to the psi, but psi is 1/3 now. In addition, the fixed point distribution is again this power law, 1 over j to the power of 1 minus chi over gamma, but with chi equals 2 rather than 1. In general, Hughes and Dunlan found that for a spin S Heisenberg model at the completely domain-symmetric fixed points, there will be critical exponents, psi equals 1 over 2s plus 1, and chi would be just 2s. Put s equals half, and you get the spin half Heisenberg results, 1 half and 1. And put s equals 1, you get these. Now, using this domain wall theory, we can calculate the entanglement entropy. Now, before, when we looked at the spin-half Heisenberg model, we had this formula. Twice the entropy of a singlet over how long it takes to form a singlet times how long you have. But now we don't have singlets anymore. We have these complicated configurations. But we can generalize it to discuss what's the average entanglement entropy of a closed configuration over how long it takes to form a closed configuration times how long you have to renormalize your segment. We need to find out what's the probability of each closed configuration in this model. We need to find out the entanglement of it. And then we need to find the average length scale, our g time, of each closed configuration. To give you a flavor of this calculation, let's start by considering what's the entanglement entropy across the partition that sits on the bond that's formed by a 1-1 domain. Turns out that with probability half, you know, these two spin halves on the edges will form another singlet. This will give us entanglement entropy of 1 across the partition. This is a closed configuration now. We can forget about it and start counting again. But the other probability half gives you, with the other probability half, there's a chance that this, you know, spin halves actually interact ferromagnetically. They form a spin 1 site, which then we need to proceed and decimate and see how it forms a closed configuration. And for that, we don't know what the entanglement entropy is until the closed configuration forms. In fact, it can form in many different ways. A spin 1 cluster can just get decimated to one side with two singlets. It can form a more complicated closed configuration like these. This is supposed to scare you. And apologies, I just don't have any way of representing all this information. But the idea is that there are many configurations, and we need to find the probabilities, which turns out to be not so tough. The bigger the closed configuration is, the probability that it forms actually dies off algebraically, like pretty much 1 over 4 to some power. Now, there's always the probability that this will form a bigger spin 1. This is summarized in this column in the left, again, with the same probabilities. Entanglement entropies we can also calculate. In this case, we'll have entanglement entropy of 1 across this partition. And as the configuration becomes bigger and bigger, the entanglement entropy also becomes more complicated. And if we form ferromagnetic bonds, we need to follow it further to find what it is. We try to do it the best we can. And we can do it in a perturbation series that converges as 1 over 6 to the n. So you can get very close and very good closed form answers with very good accuracy, but you can't do it really exactly. So here are the results. Generally, we have this rule. We need to calculate the average entanglement for closed configurations, how long it takes. Now, the easiest thing to say is how long we have to renormalize the segment of length L. Because we know that delta of log gamma, here I marked it with little l, is psi times log L, which in this case is 1/3 log L. Now, the RG time for each closed configuration we find exactly to be 3/2. Compare that with 3 for the random singlet phase. Now, the average entanglement per configuration we find out to be extremely, extremely close to 4/3. So like 10 to the minus 3 far away from 4/3. Now, you may ask whether, if I know how to do the sum exactly for all configurations, whether I'll get 4/3. And the answer is unfortunately no, because this is an upper limit. So and that gives us an answer for the entanglement entropy at the Haldane to random singlet critical point, which is 1/3, 69 log 2, minus a little bit, times log 2L. And this thing in the brackets here is the effective central charge that we were out to get, the universal effective central charge of this fixed point. So we need to take score in the sense that the fixed point that we looked at is a descendant of a conformal field theory. It's a descendant of the SU2 level 2 fixed point of a pure Heisenberg chain with spin 1 tuned with the B-quadratic coupling where the Haldane phase is destroyed. This, although we never proved this, but it's highly suggested that it's unstable upon introduction of randomness to this fixed point that we were just considering. This central charge is what we calculated in the previous slide, and that point is unstable to the random singlet phase, which appears at very large randomness. So let's see. The pure central charge is 3/2. The central charge we got is actually smaller, 69 log 2. Calculated very hard to just find that the answer is 1/3, which is smaller than 3/2. And this is bigger than the central charge over at this point, which is log 3, 1.1. So now, this inequality is the first conjecture I discussed, the possibility that maybe the pure central charge decays going to the random central charge. We know that there are counterexamples. This seems to go along with the idea that when you flow from one infinite randomness fixed point to another, the effective central charge drops, and here it's true. That's pretty much it, just to give you a flavor of future work. Well, if you wish, you can actually take all this system and calculate with it the entanglement entropy for bigger spin chains. It's possible, it may not be so easy. Now, another interesting direction is to consider other type of infinite randomness fixed points along the direction that Nick Bornstein and Kun Yang took, and look at other infinite randomness fixed points in non-abelian chain. Turns out they have a very interesting set of those. That's something that we're thinking about. And, you know, given that this worked, maybe it's possible to take a stab at trying to prove this infinite randomness generalization for a C-theorem, or maybe disprove. That's pretty much it. Thanks for your attention. Well, I mean, I hate to say it, but it's a little too naive because this random singlet type, this infinite randomness type renormalization group, this real space renormalization group, only works very well at one dimension. At two dimension, it'll produce states that order. So I don't know how to apply it in two dimensional.
Sure, no, I'm talking about one dimension.
Uh huh. Sorry, then I misunderstood. So
you have one dimension, you apply your RG, and you can get...
For like pure systems? Pure chains?
Sure, initially, yes. Random pure chains. And then you end up to one singlet, and then the entropy of it is the logarithm of the dimension of its number of it. So, you get this log D.
Uh-huh. So it's true that each singlet contributes log D. Yeah, and that's the origin.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. It's the entropy of the singlet. Because in the formula that this formula that we're thinking of. Here we have this formula. Here we have the entropy of the singlet, and the time it takes for the singlet to form times the time it takes to decimate the whole segment. Now this is dictated by the critical exponents of the fixed point you're looking at, namely random singlet. It's this 1/2 log L. This is also determined actually by the scaling of the fixed point, not by the details of the quantum mechanics of the state. And it's 3 for it's 3 for random singlet states. So what you have left is just the entropy per singlet. And that's exactly log D. And in that you're absolutely correct. Yeah. No questions?